Now stay tuned for To Your Health, where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating over 20 years of sustainable fine dining in the downtown mall. And by Rebecca's Natural Food in the Barracks Road Shopping Center. Now here is your host, MC Blair.
Good morning, good morning. Good morning to you. I'm MC Blair, and this is To Your Health. Right here, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And I'm here with Michael Riley and Renard Turner. Michael Riley is Slow Money. How are you, Michael?
Good morning. I'm great. Thanks for having me, MC. Appreciate it.
And,
good to be back.
Renard Turner is a farmer and a recipient of Slow Money. So how did that work for you?
Well, good morning. I'm happy to be here. It's been working great. I'm very thankful for the opportunity to be a recipient of Slow Money's zero interest loans. For small farmers, this is really a godsend in that it allows us to have the opportunity to advance our farming operations in ways that we would not be able to otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And what is Slow Money, Michael?
What is Slow Money? It's a program that is really intended to fill the gap that exists in financing for small mid-scale farms around the country. The program started, it's called really more of a movement than a program. It started about 10 years ago and was really sort of a byproduct of the slow food movement, which started, oh gosh, maybe what, 20 or 25 years ago.
Yeah,
it started in Italy, actually, in response to fast food. And so slow food was born out of that. And then slow money came along really sort of as a derivation of slow food, but the same principle that, you know, we live in a world where money is sort of thrown around fast and furiously and out without really much regard to what the end result is really in terms of good that it's doing in the world. It's great, you know, if you're getting a 12% return on your money, everybody loves that. But really, what good is the money doing to benefit the world in some good way? And that really is the fundamental principle behind it. And so the program, the movement, you know, again, sort of flourished around the country, and there had been some efforts to kind of get it going in Virginia, but nothing really had ever taken hold. And I had been, as you know, involved in the local food movement here now for many years. And through a contact I'd made with that involvement, I met a gentleman by the name of Hunter Hopcroft, who is a partner at JM Stock and had run their store down in Richmond for a while. And he and I put our heads together and said, you know, we really need something like this in Virginia. And so we started about a year ago, May 2018. Mm-hmm. With our program, and we're a nonprofit, so the way it works really is really quite simple. I mean, people think again of money as, you know, investing, and that's really what we're doing. Even though we're a nonprofit, we're just investing in a different way. You know, the return is not like, oh, here have, you know, 3 or 4 or 5%. The return is investing in a local farmers, local food system, and developing healthy soil and good nutritious food for our community, and building some resilience into our local community for the future. And so what we do is we again, as a nonprofit, collect charitable contributions, grant money, and that goes into a fund, a revolving loan fund, and we make loans, 0% loans from that fund. And we're off and running, and again, it's great to work with the farmers. I love doing it. It really is so meaningful to me personally, but also, you know, just I think as in terms of what we're doing, again, to support local agriculture in a way that is really does not exist otherwise.
And that's true.
Yeah.
And Renard, as a recipient, I know that obviously has helped you.
Absolutely.
In your farming. So tell us about your farm.
Okay. The name of the farm is Vanguard Ranch, and my wife, Shanette, and I started this back in 1996 or so, but since 2006, when I stopped working at UVA on the hospital side, I've been a full-time farmer. We are organic and sustainable in everything that we do. I've served a stint as the past president of the Virginia Association for Biological Farming, and I've also served on the Virginia State University School of Agriculture Advisory Council, and even did a stint under Secretary Vilsack under the United States Department of Agriculture and Minority Farm Advisory Council. So I've been an activist in farming for a number of years. Mm-hmm. What Slow Money is about, it really, and I have to echo Michael on this, it's really a movement. We're really seriously working to change the paradigm about how food is grown, how food is distributed, and making a difference in lowering the carbon footprint in our area. That's very important. If we're going to save this planet, see, the bigger picture here is not just about the small farms. It's about the securing a greener world for everyone in the future.
Food security.
Well, yeah. Food security and life security. We don't get it straight. I mean, you know, everything from saving the bees to cleaning the air to cleaning the water to, you know, building living soils, to reducing how far we transport our foods, to reducing the chemical inputs, to reducing the effect of companies like, you know, Monsanto. I almost hate to say that word. Mm. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, people, this is a serious wake-up call for those of us who are serious activists in a movement of making life better. Mm-hmm. And if we want the children and the grandchildren to have something that's heritable, clean, and good, it's time to make those changes now. So what Slow Money does is super significant because small farmers struggle just to survive. When you go to the banks, if you're not a large entity, you know, with like, you know, a 10-page resume of financial securities, they're really not wanting to speak to you. So you have very limited resources. Myself as an African-American farmer, those resources are even more limited because, mm-hmm. you know, as you know, African-American farmers in this country are about 1.4%. Yeah. Of the farmers that are left. Now, as a group, as a people, we own less land now than we did in 1935. In 1935, African Americans owned more land than they do in 2019. There's lots of reasons for that, but that is a fact that few people know. But it is a fact. So Slow Money, to me, was super good news. I was able to build a squabbery. Again, if you're a small farmer, you have to find niche markets that work for you. You can't do what everyone else is doing, which, of course, makes it more difficult for the conventional lending institutions to look at you. The fact of the matter is that conventional lending institutions don't really look at people that look like me anyway in the first place. You know, been there, done that, been through those routes with them. Most of the time, you get nowhere because they don't take you seriously. Why? Because they don't see black farmers. Why? Because they don't see black people as farmers. They see black people as farm workers and farm laborers traditionally, not farm owners. Huge difference. You know, so that paradigm is something that Slow Money is helping me to change. And the work I do is to bring other people on board, to show them what can be done, and hopefully to inspire other people who look like me to try to do the same types of things.
Wow. So you know, we were talking about food security earlier, and I had some ideas, but you seem to have sustainable methods. And what does that look like?
Well, you know, sustainable is key to me. Mm-hmm. To me, it's not an either-or proposition. It's a must proposition. We must change the way we're doing things in order to secure a future for humanity on this planet. There's a lot of things that are wrong. We all get that. But we all have to accept more of the responsibility of either being part of the solution or part of the problem. If we want to change this, we have to look at how we utilize all the resources in our life. Food, energy, housing, transportation, educational systems, all of that need to be closely re-examined to see, are they really sustainable and are they working for the common good of all mankind? If not, we need to fix it. You know, I personally am an advocate of a borderless world. We, you know, I think that we're going to need to move into a direction where we get rid of these artificial boundaries. That's a topic for another day. But
True. We
have a lot of boundaries that need to be removed in order for people to really truly liberate themselves. So farming to me is an act of liberation. Small to medium-sized sustainable and organic farms to me are the key to securing a sustainable, biologically safe, clean food system network. I would rather see 25,000 small family farms than five huge mega farms.
I'm with you on that. You know, that's absolutely correct. Now, so, Michael, do you think that, I know you think this, what is the future of Slow Money and how could that, obviously it's through grants and through donations and all this sort of thing, possibly those people that give to NPR, you know? I mean, there's a big pot of money there.
Absolutely.
And so possibly if they could, I mean, I'm just throwing this out. And
sure.
I see something that could spread nationwide.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we hopefully can tap into sort of the sentiment of people who understand that our world is changing. I think I assume people listening to this radio station don't have to be convinced of that, that we are on the cusp of tremendous upheaval, tremendous change. And the way we do things, the way we have done things, certainly for the last 100 years in particular, is not sustainable. We know that. That's a fact. It just really isn't. And so we're going to have to look at a new way of doing things. And food production is one thing that I believe will dramatically change. I think we all collectively know how we feel about CAFOs, and we'd like them to go away quickly. But you know, we have to be mindful of the hardship that that does cause people. You know, there is a lot of upheaval involved in that, and there are a lot of good, well-intentioned people, farmers in particular, who are part of that system. And so this is all very complicated. It really is. We have to be mindful of all the repercussions that will be involved in as we go through this upheaval, and the people that will suffer again are the people that are don't have the wealth and the resources to adapt very quickly. So, just getting back specifically to what we do, I think really, sort of the ethos behind sort of this whole organization really is to create that resilience, to provide something that really is so critical to the way we need to survive and produce the food that we need to survive. Farms. Small farms, in particular, small mid-sized farms, they're really not looked on as businesses, but they are businesses. And so we can say, all right, well, we need to treat farms as businesses. In the financial world, we say, okay, well, we'll do that, but now we're going to hold them to the same, the same criteria that we hold, local tech startup or something like that. And that's not going to work either, because no. It's not the same thing. So what we're really trying to do is create an organization that understands really all the imperatives that are involved in farming on a small, mid-sized scale locally in the community, and to provide a solid foundation for years to come. I mean, that's the legacy that I personally want to leave behind is a structure that can support farming, that can understand what the needs are and move, and adapt to those needs over time. And again, build in that resilience. And that's a key word, into a word that's being used more and more for important reasons. That right now we live in a world that's not very resilient at all. And for future generations to continue to exist, in this world, we need to have a resilient system in place to feed ourselves and to support that infrastructure. And so that's really, what we're looking to do. And yeah, we'd love to, certainly have folks who contribute to organizations like NPR and other, we don't really want to take money away from other good organizations. There's plenty of money out there that I think is can be redirected to better use. And so hopefully we can take advantage of that.
Well, one thing I've noticed, folks, you are listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And I am talking with Michael Riley and Renard Turner. Of Vanguard Farm, Michael Riley, Slow Money, and you mentioned soil health, and I know that I've always said squirmy soil, lots of microbes, and I know that there's some farms that never freeze because that microbial action is so strong, and it wicks the groundwater; it's drought proof, so. I know you're familiar with that. So yes. How do you achieve that at Vanguard?
Well, I'll tell you what we did. I'm a hardcore naturalist to begin with. It has a lot to do with my spiritual belief system. But what we do on the farm is mimic nature, because I think that nature got it right and man screws it up, basically. So I raise meat goats, and the wonderful thing about goats and why we made that choice was because they have a very Yeah, they have a low carbon footprint.
Right.
They walk around and basically will scatter very valuable manure. We will also collect it and compost it and spread it on the farm. We encourage a diverse forage base, so we do not go in and monocrop and plant just one type of grass to fill up a field. That's not nature. The model of nature is that you have a diverse, very varied, and biodynamic forage base. All different kinds of forbs and grasses and weeds and shrubs, they're supposed to be there. We mimic nature. So when we started the farm, it took 3 to 5 years to establish the pastures that we have now. And really, it's more of a forage base, but it's what the Creator put there and what grows there naturally. We're not trying to replace it with something that we consider more brilliant, because generally we're not more brilliant. You know, that's just the mistake. So the first thing we do is we mimic nature. The second thing we do is we use no pesticides, herbicides, or any harmful chemicals. If it's not Organic Material Review Institute approved, it doesn't come on our farm. You know, people say, well, how do you keep your fence lines clean? Well, I go out there and I either would weed whack or torch it. I do not use Roundup.
Yay.
That's not going to ever happen.
No.
Never. The other thing we do is, you know, in our the health of our animal herd, I'm not using antibiotics. I'm not giving them the shots that they say that you're supposed to give them. So after 12 years of raising goats, we have perfected a system that works very well. And basically, once again, we mimic nature. So I ask myself, how do the wild animals survive without our intervention? Who gives them shots at birth? Who cuts their umbilical cords? Who sprays them with iodine? Who trims the hoofs? Look at these savannas in Africa where you've got these massive migrations of millions and billions of animals. Who takes care of them? You know, how many shots do they get? Who's trimming their hoofs?
Nature.
You know, nature. If they're a bad mother, guess what? Yeah, the baby doesn't survive,
right.
And the mother won't either.
Yeah.
You know, so that's pretty much natural selection, and we also are, we live in concert with that. So our soil health is very important, because everything starts with the soil. So we put, the animals give back to it. We condition that further by using selective ground covers, which we will incorporate back into the soil. We rotate so that we don't just plant one area and use it over and over again. If I plant vegetables in one area in 1 year, the goats graze there the next year. Then I'll plant vegetables in that area again. And we rotate how we use the land. So it always has a season of rest in between being utilized for growing food for human consumption. That's how we do it.
It's very interesting, Renard, because, you know, I watch all sorts of documentaries and nature programs. And one of the things, the common thread is, you know, when we were hunter-gatherers, we followed the herds because the herds knew where everything was to sustain the herd. And then the men would follow the herds, obviously take one or two when they could. It was tough. When they never planted anything.
Right.
And then about 10,000 years ago, we committed agriculture.
Yeah, well,
everything went to heck.
Yeah,
know?
Well, and, you know, I think the very encouraging thing is that we're an age of information and knowledge that far exceeds, obviously, anything else in human history. And so, yeah, we've been doing agriculture, you know, pretty wrong for the last 10,000 years.
Yeah.
I think we're now at a point where we understand these things, and a lot of these things that, like Renard was talking about, that, you know, most people either just had to know intuitively or they just didn't do it in the past. And now we have this knowledge, and that to me is really it's very encouraging to know that we're at a point in our existence where we have a choice to make, and with the knowledge we have, we can make, you know, better choices than we're doing now, or we can continue to make the, you know, the wrong choices. And I think that when you see the people out there farming and the organizations that are supporting farming and local food, there's so many positive signs to look toward, despite the fact that, you know, we live in a world where there's a lot of despair, a lot of hardship, a lot of wrong being done. But you know, I think there's positive movement that I think is really, really encouraging.
I think you're right, Michael. And one of the things I'd like to talk about when we come back is how to, because most of the, we call them factory farms, and most of those are actually contracted small farmers. Mm-hmm. And they're feeling the heat, and I want to talk about possibly a solution of breaking up the factory, getting the corporate scenario out of that picture, and turning it back into the small farmers. Because I think if we come up with a solution for that, we got it right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we're back. I'm MC Blair. I'm talking with Renard Turner of Vanguard Farm and Michael Riley of Slow Money. And before we went out, I mentioned possibly a solution, a possible solution of breaking up the factory food system, but doing it with minimal impact on the actual contract farmers. How do you see that happening, if it could happen at all?
I think it's possible that it can happen. I'm not sure about the minimal impact part of it. I think that, you know, anytime you talk about breaking something up and starting something new, there's bound to be some pains during the shakeup. I think that we need to focus on regional food supplies. So the first step is to regionalize our food supply, and we as a society need to understand that, you know, here in Virginia, you're probably not going to get pineapples in December because of the fact that it takes tremendous amount of energy to get that product delivered to you, you know, out of season. So we need to learn to live seasonally, which is what most indigenous people do all around this planet, because it's just much safer and better. And we can't reduce our carbon footprint without changing our mindset. So the biggest problem is re-educating people to basically, Americans are spoiled. We're used to too much of everything with very little effort getting it. And that's mainly because we exploit people all around the world so that we can have plenty of everything. And that position is has to change.
It does. It's not sustainable. It's I heard somebody call themselves a local four. And
local
I said,
four,
what
like
is that? And they said they only eat locally produced products, produce and meat in season.
That's a good solution, and that's the direction that we all need to be moving in. But we have to understand what that really means. That means that we have to curtail what we have, these desires for exotic, out of season, whatever it is. We have to change the way that we look at food. Yes, I salute localvores. I think that's a very smart move, and we need to do that. And you have needed localvores and regionalvores and all of that as part of, you know, the solution. As far as small farmers are concerned, I think that people need to find the local farmers near them, get to know them, and support them. And that way we won't have to be victims of some of these big box stores, like even your Whole Foods. You know, Whole Foods is close. Everybody in Charlottesville knows it. You know, they're importing food from all in the world. Here's the bigger question. How many agricultural workers were exploited in the process of getting those products to us? And we have to think about this.
Yes.
You know, in our desire to be well-fed, sometimes we are mistreating even people all around the world.
That
is not good.
Yeah, and I've noticed that with Whole Foods, I asked them about local beef. And I get my beef from a local farmer, Wolf Creek in Madison, knows what he's doing. And they said, well, we don't do that because he can't supply the entire region. And it's like, give me a break.
You know, that model is fine. See, that's the corporate model.
Right.
And this is the problem with America.
It's true.
That we are so used to corporate everything that in our brains have been incorporated. We think like corporations. That is what we have to change, because we're so used to just following suit and blindly following, you know. So they have a sale on grapefruits at Whole Foods, and everybody will say, oh, that's great, I can go buy. Yeah, but how many farmers are exploited in this process? Did they get a fair price? You know, how was that product produced? How were the migrant workers treated that had to pick those? You know, either you're part of this solution or we're part of the problem. If you really want to be a change, you have to be concerned about other human beings along the way. You know, we're too greedy. I mean, I'm saying we as an American population at large, too greedy, too selfish.
Yeah, we want it all right now.
Want it all yesterday with the least amount of effort, and really don't give a damn about how much somebody had to go through pain and suffering to get it to us. That is no longer acceptable.
I was just going to say, what I see is these contract farmers that are in the factory farm system, if we were to break that up, and I think it would have to, you know, one little section at a time. You couldn't just, you know, all over. But if you did that, and then Slow Money could step in to those farmers and say, here you go. Here's what we're going to do for you. You know, get this, 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 and this.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I think we see that as a perfect example of what we can do. Because again, I'm cautious of a system where you come in and break up the factory food system. Because again, there are a lot of people that would, you know, well-intentioned people that get hurt by that, right? So we want to be mindful of that. And I think the better way to do that is to work with local farms. To provide maybe a different path for them, right, and incentivize them to perhaps, you know, rather than growing commodity crops for the factory farm system, maybe take their land and think about growing some local crops that can be consumed by people instead of animals at some feedlot farm.
Might even get a better price.
Right. And so what we can do is we can provide the financing to support that process. And that's ultimately, you know, again, the structure that we want to have in place where we can come in and say, all right, well, let's help a farm to make that transition. Let's provide the financing or whatever it is to support whatever they need to make that transition. And, you know, we're starting to see that already. I mean, again, there are great organizations out there. There's an organization that started about a little over a year ago called the Common Grain Alliance. And it is a network of growers, millers, and bakers in the Mid-Atlantic region. And they are trying to foster a better grain economy that has not really existed. Most of the grains grown in this state, again, they're grown conventionally with a lot of pesticides and herbicides, and they're sent off somewhere else into the factory food system. And the Common Grain Alliance is really trying to work with farmers to say, look, you know, if we have the demand. If we can create the demand from bakers and maybe even, you know, home bakers to, you know, source locally, then why don't we help you to transition from, you know, a conventional, you know, wheat farm to maybe growing some more local grains that can be can stay locally and go, you know, without pesticides, grown organically, and they can go to local bakeries and restaurants that are baking bread and that sort of thing. So that's a good example of how this can work. And so I think the finances are needed, and we hope that as we continue to grow, that we can provide the structure to do that, and that will require more than what we're doing now. I mean, in some cases, the food system is going to require more than just, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 loans to farmers. That's always going to be a foundation of what we do. So we kind of see our future path sort of a dual type of role that we can play. And one, again, is providing that nimble capital that we're already doing. You know, few questions asked. I mean, you know, there are questions asked.
Obviously.
We want to know, but it's not the rigor that, you know, that you face when you go into a bank and all that. And so that's so important. And we want to continue doing that. We want to grow this fund. I think it could potentially grow well over several million dollars. Why not? You know, I mean, my gosh, that's a drop in the hat for some.
If you build it, they'll come, right?
So, you know, imagine a revolving pool of money that's used again to provide nimble 0% interest to farms that need $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, whatever for their farm. And then another pool of capital that would tackle bigger issues within the system, whether it's processing. We have, a lot of kinks in the system right now that are impediments, again, to growing the local food system. Processing is a huge one. You hear every livestock farmer complain about it. Going back to sort of the grain, local grain economy, storage, processing, those are also issues there as well. So, looking at things like co-ops, whether it's a farming co-op or a food co-op or whatever it is, and trying to catalyze more of that. Well, I mean, I think if I may be wrong, but I don't think there is one farm co-op in this state. And that's a shame, I think, because you look around other states in the country, their farm co-ops are starting to flourish and take off. And so we again want to be catalysts for initiatives like that to help help finance those types of projects. And so that's going to take require a bigger pool of money. And that, again, may be a different structure for people who are interested in supporting us, where we, you know, in addition to providing us with a charitable contribution, maybe in some cases we can provide like a fund that would maybe give mm-hmm. them 2 or 3 or 4% return for these bigger projects that need to be financed.
You know, I had a thought while you were speaking. What, I mean, if there was some, I know City Schoolyard Gardens, mm-hmm. they're really doing a great job teaching kids to work together and,
absolutely.
You know, from different cultures and skin colors and religions and everything. And what if, you know, one or two of them caught the bug and wanted to start a farm, could slow money maybe help them find 5 or 10 acres? And
sure, yeah. Again, the opportunities are really, you know, I hate to say endless. Nothing's really endless.
Yeah.
But there are numerous opportunities that are out there, mm-hmm. And helping farmers, you know, helping catalyze new farms is certainly a big opportunity. And land is a huge deal. I mean, just, you know, access to land is the biggest challenge among young farmers and for aging farmers, you know, passing along that land. And finding ways to make sure that these farms are not sold off for development. So the whole land thing is a huge again opportunity, is a challenge, but also an opportunity that we are excited to participate in helping find solutions down the road.
I know so many people. You're listening to Your Health 94.7 WPVC, talking with Michael Riley and Menard Turner of Vanguard Farm. And it's the, you know, I was talking about kids, you know, catching the bug and you guys helping them find land and all that sort of thing. And I know you, Renard, mm-hmm. have done that, mm-hmm. you know, and you know,
yes.
taught and worked and stuff like that with the agricultural department. And so do you see any future in that?
I do. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, I see it as a positive move. Anytime you're educating children about how things grow, how food is sourced, and introduce them to new healthy avenues to eating better, I think that's very positive. I was fortunate in my youth. I grew up for a couple of years in California, where we had vocational agriculture and science taught on a high school level. That's where I started in agriculture. I would like to see a return of vocational agricultural classes in the schoolrooms. I think we need to revisit that. I think we need to encourage that. We need to question why these children are not being exposed to those types of things. You see, oftentimes it's a lack of exposure that makes these huge differences. So if you don't grow up knowing anything about a farm, how food is grown, where it comes from, and you only condition children to punch keys and do, you know, cyber intelligence and stock market investments and insurance type things, they're never going to get a picture of life on a different level. So I think that with City School, and they've come to my farm, by the way, and brought children out a couple of times, and I always find that it's entertaining to me. And I do welcome the opportunity to expose children, you know, particularly African American children who never get much exposure to.
Right.
Even being outdoors a lot. And seeing a farmer, seeing another black farmer is pretty enlightening to them. So I hope to be that kind of a person who can help them to see that there are other vocational opportunities out there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they can consider agriculture as a vocation and as a legitimate business, because by and large it's not considered as a legitimate business on a small farm scale. So I think it's a good thing, but I also think that in some ways it has some limitations because, you know, the African American population still continues to be under oppressive, racist policies that have been here since the inception of this country. We all know and recognize that. I think that limiting the vision to just an urban vision is another restriction, and that restriction sometimes is not good. I think that we need more than just a slice of the pie. We need to be able to have access to the whole pie. And that means land ownership. That means looking at land as a heritable resource, because that's what it is. Fortunes in this country were largely developed through land ownership and usage of land, even mostly stolen lands. That is a fact. So limiting the children just to doing raised beds or rooftop gardens without giving them access to seeing agriculture as a vocation where you can actually own 500 or 1,500 or 5,000 acres of land, that's a totally different thing. And they're not getting that piece of the pie, and that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
That to me is a shame. That needs to be addressed, because what we're really saying to them is, hey, you know what? We're going to teach you how to grow a squash and a tomato and a cucumber. That's not going to serve the whole community. That may serve your family. That's good. But that's not introducing them to agriculture as a business and as a vocation. And it certainly doesn't put them in line to have a heritable wealth generation based on a raised bed here and there.
Yeah. I see the I always talked about community-based agriculture. And what I've gotten just from today is, what, you know, if the whole community bought into this, good luck, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if the whole community did buy into this through education, through, you know, constantly talking, two things. Number one, today, when children inherit the family farm, so often the developers come and knock on their door and say, hey, we'll give you $12,000 an acre, and they're saying, oh, wait a minute, this is a 5,000-acre farm.
Yeah, you know, you're right. That's a big issue.
Yeah,
I've talked to many farmers.
Absolutely.
Right now,
yeah. But if they were raised, as you raise your children, to participate and, you know, keep this thing going, and if the whole community is in on that, then all of a sudden we're pulling together as a community to keep this sustainable food system sustainable and whole without selling it off.
Yeah.
You know, then it's almost they've been brought up to they're obligated. I mean, and not in a mean way, but they want to be. They want to participate.
Yeah.
And everybody, and then you get the peer pressure working, you know. So I kind of see that, and maybe that's a panacea, you know. But,
well, I think it's inevitable, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be a different way of living on this planet at some point. It's a question of when will that be? How will that evolve? How, you know, what's the progress? You know, what's the timeline of that progress, and what's the upheaval that will occur, but there is going to be a different way of living, and
mm-hmm.
I personally believe, again, much of it is going to be rural based. Anticipate again, as we deal with the changes that will occur through the climate and the way we currently live is, again, it's just not sustainable. We continue to carry on every day as if it is, while the world has a different idea, and eventually it's going to catch up to us. And so I think there's going to be a different way of living, and I do believe that a lot of the things that we're laying the groundwork for now will flourish down the road at some point.
That sounds good to me, and we'll get back to that in just a moment. And we're back. I'm talking with Michael Riley of Slow Money and Renard Turner of Vanguard Ranch. And you mentioned earlier that you do meat goats as well as your produce.
Correct.
Yeah.
We've been doing meat goats for close to, I don't know, about 12 years now. Looks like I lost my...
Oh, okay. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay. I got you. We're back live.
All right, good.
Yeah, we've been raising meat goats on our farm for about 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that we moved to do goats was because of their small carbon footprint. You know, goat meat is the most widely consumed red meat on the planet Earth on a daily basis. And many people don't know this, but that is a fact. Google it, look it up. See, part of America's disease, if you will, is that America always sees itself as the center of the universe. Mm. And that is certainly not the case. America is not the biggest country, if you will, on this planet. You know, sometimes we take ourselves too seriously. More people eat goats than chicken and beef combined on a daily basis. Goats live just about anywhere on the planet except like Antarctica. But they're quite user-friendly. They can maximize the use of marginal resources and land and give a good return on and product, whether that product is meat, milk, cheese, yogurt, or skin, hides, whatever. Goats are mentioned more than any other animal in the Bible. These are all facts.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to go to goats. We were at a horse show down in Lexington. We were looking at buying horses, you know, for pleasure. And in the brochure was an article about meat goats. This is how things happened. And so we took the brochure home, and the next morning I got up and I'm having my coffee, and I'm reading this thing about meat goats, and I didn't believe it myself. Now, I had raised sheep before in Future Farmers of America back in my high school days in California, so I was a little familiar with small hoof stock. But as I read this about goats, I said, this is interesting. And we had sheep on the farm. We got rid of the sheep because they were eating us out of house and home because we did it backwards. We didn't get the forage right before we got the animals on board. Big mistake. You always want your forage right and your fences right and then add the animals. But anyway, we started raising goats, went through a couple of different strains to find what works for us. I did a stint as the national secretary for the American Kiko Goat Association, which was quite interesting. Learned about the politics of the show goat world and blah, blah, blah. And we now raise Miatonic meat goats, which are in a North American land race breed, also known as stiff-legged and fainting goats. And we have selectively bred on our farm for 10 years a strain that we now call the Bangus, which is an acronym for the best all-natural goat in the United States. No chemicals, no injections of any kind. We don't grain them. These goats do the job on forage, and they are awesome. And the food truck came about as a result. You see, oftentimes things happen, I won't say by accident, but by fortune. I was at the state fair. I was thirsty. I wanted a lemonade. Went to one concession, and they were fresh out. And the guy says, go down three concessions. I'm going to call my cousin. He makes lemonade, and I'll tell him you're on your way, because it was about to close up. We walked down there. I said, hey, the guy up three concessions up sent me down here. He says, yeah, he called me. He's my cousin. I said, well, you got lemonade? He said, yeah, I got a lemonade. He squeezed the fresh lemon, shook it up, gave me my lemonade. Had a conversation with him and found out there were five members of his family that had concession trailers, and that they did that every year, and that they traveled around on the festival circuits, and they made good money. So I asked him, I said, well, if you don't mind, you know, what kind of money is in this? He says, well, I make about $77,000. And I said, that's pretty good for a year. He goes, oh, no. That's this week.
Okay, folks, I'm out of here.
That's what I said. And I, you know, I'm like, you know, can you repeat that, please? You know, I said, so how many years have you been doing? He says, well, I've been doing it about 18 years. And then he pointed out five other concession trailers there that were all members of his family. And what he said that made sense, and I'll never forget this, he says, when you turn 18 in our family, you get a concession trailer. Yeah, and we follow this circuit around.
It's a beautiful model.
And we work 6 months out of the year, and then I go to my fishing home in Florida, and I fish in the winter.
Not bad.
And I said, wow, I need to rethink what I'm doing. So I went home that evening, and I started Googling concession trailers. And for about the next 6 weeks, I studied, and I got a book on concessions, and I borrowed money. And I went down to Florida, and I had a custom-made 20-footer, and I had to buy a truck to pull it. I had never driven a full-size pickup truck and never pulled a trailer, but we went down to Fort Lauderdale, and we hooked up, and we pulled that sucker back. I almost took out a couple of gas tanks pulling in there because I had no experience pulling a trailer. But we made it back, and then we started having our goats processed, and then we came up with formulating a recipe for our goat burgers and our curry goat and our goat kebabs, which we still do. So things kind of happened, and it morphed into that. But, yeah, the goats are a big part of our farm. My wife loves them. They're easy to manage. They are very good at converting rough forage into a high-quality product, and people do love our product. No chemicals, no hormones, no additives, no injections, and no grain. These goats are good.
I'm one of those people, folks. I actually first met Renard, and I just realized it, at the Heritage Harvest Festival. It was actually, I think it was the first.
Probably up at Monticello.
Monticello. And I had my little stand there. I was doing chicken Caesar with pastured chicken and all that. And my barbecue from pastured pork and that. And so, you know, and I went over to his trailer, and I got a goat burger. And, oh, my goodness. He's right, folks.
Oh,
so if you ever see that truck, it's just you get to it. And it's a gosh, what a nice truck.
Yeah. Well, we'll invite the public out to the farm. I think we're going to do something like every month at the farm and invite people out because we really want to put our face to our product. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're kind of anti the big commercial setups. We want people to know us and we want to, you know, I'd rather have, you know, 200 regular customers than 2,500 people that I don't know.
Right.
You know, it's really a personal quest for us. So we're going to open up the farm to people and set up the food truck and have people come out and just, you know, come out with their family, whatever, get a goat burger, kebab, or as we've added squab to our mm-hmm. repertoire as well. We're going to be doing that soon. They're down on eggs now. Again, people used to eat a lot of pigeon. If you don't know, a squab is a baby pigeon. It's really an epicurean delight. Many gourmands know this. It's not just here that people eat them, but French cuisine, Moroccan cuisine, North African cuisine, Mediterranean cuisine, squabs are eaten a lot every day as well. So we strive to do that which is not normally done. That's kind of our niche. But goats rock. I mean they're pretty neat animals and trust that they are quiet, clean and not stinky.
Right, that's true. That's very true. And again, of course, I know Gail Hobbs Page of Caramont Farms. And
yes.
She's big on goats, and then makes cheese.
That's right. Yeah. I'm familiar with their product. It's good.
It is good. And she's a real...
It's a good example of a local operation.
Yes, absolutely. And they're assets to the community.
Truly.
And I wanted to kind of jump back and just tell people that when Renard was talking about nature... And how nature, you know, planted a field, if you will. I grew up in Annandale, Virginia, 7 miles west of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. When I was there, you know, the roads were curved and had ditches on both sides, and, you know, not like it is now. Mm-hmm. And we had fields, and they were abandoned farms that hadn't been farmed in years. And we'd walk through the field, and there'd be, you know... probably rye grass or whatever was there. But all of a sudden, we'd come up a whole patch of clover. It's like, what the heck? You know, this whole patch of clover.
Yeah.
And especially the red clover, which I ate, and then I later found out that the red clover is actually a really good preventative medicine.
Yeah.
And then you'd come along, and there'd be, you know, something else and something else. Just these patches.
Well, biodiversity.
Exactly.
Right? You've
gotta have nature does its own biodiversity.
Right. Exactly.
If it just left to nature.
Look around us. I mean, we're surrounded by woods here.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you walk through the woods, there is so much diversity there.
Yes, there is.
You know, so this is the work of the Creator. It's obviously meant to be that way. We're not as smart as we think we are. I think we should I think we should totally study nature more and mimic nature, but respect it and not abuse it. What we're doing now is abusive to the land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that, you know, I remember, I'm paraphrasing here, but I remember reading years ago, it was a Native American elder who stated that, you know, if you continue to rape the land, which is your mother, you will soon starve.
Mm. Wow. Mm.
And pretty much that's where we're at now. And a lot of people don't know this, but this advent of chemical agriculture, as we know, came about after World War II when there was chemicals left over from the bomb-making part of war, and they needed to do things with the phosphorus and magnesium stockpiles that were left. So, you know, the mad scientists got together and said, hey, let's make fertilizer. And, you know, industrial farming came about with that whole industrial revolution and the advent of tractors and all of that. This is a story for another day, but where we are now is a result of that. I see many people trying to slow it down and reclaim that, and that brings us back to slow money.
Slow money, slow food. And, you know, it's interesting. Years ago, I saw a study done, and they had two identical sized fields, and they grew the same crops in those fields, and they were miles apart, but it was the same, latitude.
Yeah.
So, you know, they got the same sun and the same rain and all that sort of thing. One of the fields, they used sprays, and they sprayed with herbicides and pesticides, and they lost about half their crop. The other field was totally natural, with no sprays, and they lost about half their crop. Why in the heck are we spraying our food? It's, it makes no sense.
The Rodale Institute up in Pennsylvania has been doing this for years.
Mm-hmm.
They've been doing field testing on conventional versus organic farming, and, showing the effectiveness of organic farming in terms of yields and all that. And, you know, of course, it's really hard to measure based on that. You have to look again at the holistic picture in terms of what, you know, what all the are all the repercussions of that system. You know, one of the things we didn't talk about, we sort of hit on a little bit earlier, and it kind of ties back into money, is really sort of the true cost of food. Mm. And this, again, I think plays into this whole belief that that at some point we're gonna be living in a different way as we wake up to the fact that the cost of our food, of our cheap food right now, is all a myth.
It is a myth, because if they did away with farm subsidies, that conventional food would be more expensive than organic.
If they factored in the farm subsidies, the cost of the cleanup, the cost of Renard talked about earlier, the cost to the migrant, the human cost to workers, not just in the fields, but in the restaurants, and all those things are extracted from the cost of food in the grocery store. And I think more people are recognizing that that's going to change, and that will change. And so the local food that, you know, does seem more expensive will, I think, at some point look a lot more competitive than it is now.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think you're right. Well, doggone, this has been great. I wish we had another hour.
Yeah,
keep on going. I like to wrap this thing up, folks, with what I call a two-minute drill. It may take longer than 2 minutes, but hopefully the information is pretty good. And I say, let's face it, our survival as a species depends on three basic needs being met. We need clean air to breathe, clean water to drink, and clean food to eat.
That's correct.
And it goes without saying that if we breathe dirty air, our lungs are going to suffer and our resources are going to be spent trying to heal them. However, if the air is still polluted, it's like trying to catch your shadow. The water we drink and the food we eat also has to be clean and free from poisons and carcinogens and antibiotics or any other man-made additive that slowly weakens our immune system and that leaves us with less than optimal defenses against disease. Unfortunately, clean air, clean water, and clean food is not a priority of the powers running our food and health systems. Now, if you go to an individual that's in that system and ask them face-to-face, they'll say, oh, yeah, clean water, food, and soil, and all that's very, very important. But then they go back to work, and it's business as usual, placating the corporate elite who only care about the bottom line. And I'm really interested because FDR said that corporations are the enemy of the people.
True.
And it said, yeah, there a lot of jobs are provided by corporations. However, it's the corporate structure that dictates that the bottom line is the only thing without regard to the people. I thought this country was of, by, and for the people. And I also need to add clean, healthy soil to the list, because clean food is not possible without it. Now, changing the national food system and health systems can happen, but it starts right here at home by changing one community at a time. Now, we here in Charlottesville and the surrounding counties have the land. With the concerted community effort, can achieve food security. The combined contributions of local farms, city schoolyard gardens, Urban Agricultural Collective of Charlottesville, and the community at large should be an example to us all that through education, hands-on experience, eating habits can be changed to a more healthy diet, leading to less obesity, a healthier brain, and a general feeling of well-being. You know? And we are what we eat. And that's the truth, folks. And that's not just a platitude. That is a fact. The good news is that fewer resources will be spent on health care because our children will be working beside others from different cultures and skin colors. Over time, it will result in citizens who are not only healthier, but who tend to get along, you know? You know, and then can we all just get along? Yes, we can. You know, Obama was right. Yes, we can. Now, I want to thank Michael Riley and of Slow Money and Renard Turner of Vanguard Farm for being here. And thanks for listening, folks. And remember,
thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Yeah. It's great to
really
be here.
Really enjoyed it. But remember, folks, communities working together towards food security and social acceptance
be the change
are keys to our health. That's the truth. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Be the change. You are right.